Evening, Johnny A. from Los Angeles.
Yeah. Nothing's changed. 15 years old, and I'm pushing 50. Thank you. You know, I try to listen to shares and what people are saying, and I try to be open-minded to relating to, you know, your story and something you had said that just like hit me hard in the chest. And my dad's 87 and my mom's in her 70s. Yeah, my dad married way younger, and I kind of did too. But you had said something about being there to take care of your dad. You know, I always looked up to my parents and thought that they should always be taking care of me, and it's come to a head where my parents aren't making the best decisions in life right now. And if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous and these 12 steps, traditions, and concepts, and the people that had guided me and directed me through this process and given me an idea of actually how to live life and be mindful of other people, I wouldn't be able to be there for my parents today. As much as I lack compassion and tolerance for my parents, I have to be there for them. And, can you guys hear me in the back all right? All right, cool. So, yeah, my name's Johnny. I'm an alcoholic. And I was born and raised up in Los Angeles, or fifth generation, right at home on the beach, Santa Monica. I actually did a little stint right over here on Nimitz and like SeaWorld Way or whatever it is or whatever. And I'll just tell this story real quick. And when what happened was my girlfriend dumped me. I broke both of my hands that night, and I'm driving a 68 Cougar that was green with a red hood and a black door, and and it smoked out the exhaust fumes that were coming out the back. And I was living at home with my parents, and no wonder why she left me, right? I had nothing to offer, and at the time, I was really heavily engaging in alcohol, and even back up for a minute. I'm the youngest of six. My brothers got me high in 1977 when I turned 7 years old and started giving me beer and weed to shut me up, you know. If it wasn't go play on the freeway, shave, it was here, hit this, and just be quiet. So my journey started real young, but by the time I got down here into San Diego, I was running from pain one more time. And what had happened was I had gotten really drunk one night and some dude was trying to pick up on my girl, but I had allowed it. I'm like, yo, we don't have that much money, but like flirt, do your deal in the bar, get your free cocktails. And then I was pissed after all that had gone down, you know. And I'm yelling at her in the car while I'm drunk, and I end up just pulling over and throwing the keys as far as I could into some like remote area in the neighborhood, and she just like eagle-eyed him down, and she's waiting at the house for me when I get back home. And the next morning, she leaves me. And so what ended up happening was I left my house as a stalker would. You know, I'm a stalker. And I drive out to Riverside to find her, and I drive the whole neighborhood for 2 days straight until I find her car. And then I have this temper tantrum on the ground in front of her as if that's going to win you back, right? She's like, yo, dude, you're embarrassing me. You got to go, okay? And so I end up getting in that car and driving down here to San Diego. And I have a friend who was living down here. He's like, yo, Jay, come on down here and get your head right. And I was telling Lori this story. And what had happened was he had started a stained glass business out of Tijuana. And my ears perked anytime I heard things going on down in Tijuana. And to make a long story short, I became a fugitive of San Diego and had to run real fast in my eyesore of a car smoldering back up the coast to a small town called Playa del Rey. And what had happened was I got caught shipping kilos across the border. And in that small 5-6 month period of time that I was living over here, I was really not drinking. You know, I'm not going to drink, right? but I'll smoke a lot of weed and grow weed and do this thing, and I get a notice from Detective Steve Sloan. This is over 25 years ago, by the way. Detective Steve Sloan left a business card on my front door, and it said, please contact me. Well, I do what every good drug addict alcoholic does, and I run as quickly as possible. And the reason I run, I don't know about you, I run because I don't want to take responsibility for anything. And if you don't know where I am or can't find me, then you can't prove I did it. Well, my fingerprints were obviously all over a package, and I was caught on film at a UPS store or something like that. And so I move up to Playa del Rey, and I get a lawyer, and I that's the first time I got in trouble in regards to legal trouble with drugs and alcohol. I'd never gotten a DUI, but I've crashed every single car I've ever owned while I was using. I didn't make it to prom, too drunk. I didn't make it to my graduation because I had a head-on collision on the way with a beer between my legs, smoking a joint. And, you know, that's like really what my life started to begin to look like at a very young age. And it was nothing but trouble. I remember coming home at 10, 11, 12, 13 years old, and my parents, my mom would always, my dad wouldn't do anything. He didn't care. He raised his first four, and then there was me and my brother, and he was like, it's a phase, whatever. Just leave him alone. And my mom would meet me at the door, and she would smell my fingers, and to me it smelled like coffee grinds, but it was really skunk bud. And my eyes would be bloodshot red. And I would use the old, I've been in the pool swimming, surfing at the beach, you know, I got salt in my eyes. And I never wanted to take responsibility for my behaviors. And so being the youngest of six, I've been exposed from the gate. I have a 5.5-year-old, I have a 6-year-old daughter. And I look at my daughter and I think, man, I was that old when I started getting high. I would kill somebody if they handed my daughter a joint right now, you know. But my journey began at that age, and it's the journey I needed to go through in order to get here. I was told at a very young age that I can do what I want to do, be who I want to be. There's no pressure. You don't have to be like your dad and be a musician and be a doctor and do all these successful things, go to Harvard, be Mensa. Just be a ding-dong and have fun with your life. And having older brothers who are extreme athletes, they like to skydive and race motorcycles and ski and surf. And being the youngest, I wanted to be just as good as them, if not better. And what I didn't realize until I got here was that I lived in this ego, this world of I'm better than, or I've got to be as good as, or I have to party as much as. There's a line in the book that talks about we try to prove ourselves like other people, that we can drink like other people. And being thin and lightweight, I sure as hell couldn't keep up with a lot of my friends. But my goal was to get to a place where I could. And then once I could, my ego said, I've got to do it so that I can actually turn around and call you guys lightweights. And in order to do that, I need to drink a lot. Now, these guys can drink on Friday night, Saturday night, and call it quits, but I needed to train and practice. And I, you know, so my drinking became every day, all day, every day at school, after school, at night. Now, one of the things that happened when I was a kid was I'm the youngest of six, and number five was 5 years older than me, 6'6" with a 7-foot wingspan. Mine's 6'6". I'm only 5'11". I don't know what happened to my height, but I definitely got the athletic ability. But my brother used to do anything in his power to pretty much take me out of my life. He's drowned me to the point where I've been convulsing. He's stabbed me. He's shot me. This damn thing just fell out 2 weeks ago. My nose scarring, eye scarring. I can't hear out of my right ear. You name it. He's done it. And he tried to kill me basically on a daily basis. So my mom got to a point where she was pretty much like scared of him. And rather than send him somewhere, they sent me somewhere. And what they did was they sent me to go stay with friends' houses. Now, at that age, when I was 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, all I ever wanted to do was hang out with my friends. Mom, can I stay at my friend's house? Well, no, it's not okay. And then all of a sudden, my mom's saying, you know what, go stay with your friends. Now I'm resentful at my mom because I feel abandoned. And so my first relationship, my relationship with my mom is tainted, and I start to develop this resentment with my mom. I don't feel like the number one anymore. I don't feel like I'm the special one anymore. I feel like she's not doing enough in her power to protect me. And then I'll say this as far as regards to my relationships, not just with the one first woman in my life, which was my mom, but my first relationship. In second grade, I got a girlfriend named Jennifer Smith. We used to go skiing, go hiking, go do all kinds of stuff together. My parents own a ranch, and there's horses on it, so she was one of the girls that rode horses. And I took a liking to her, and her parents liked me. And in the fifth grade, here we have 3 years of being friends. In the fifth grade, my friend Danny Strauss says to me, hey man, Lisa Gordon's the hottest chick in school. And I'm like, whoop, my ears perk up. So I asked this girl out on a date. It was a Friday. Want to go to lunch tomorrow? She says, sure. So I take Lisa Gordon out on this date. And on Monday, I'm surrounded by over 150 kids at the school. I'm in fifth grade. Surrounded by over 100, it's like this many people, surrounded me at the school. And Lisa Gordon and Jennifer Smith walked up on me, hand on hip. Did this full chicken head shit. And Jennifer Smith said, you're dumped. Ooh, I got the mode. The whole school knew before I knew, and I was totally humiliated. My first two relationships were tainted. So from that moment forward, I was never going to let a girl ever get in here again. And my relationships have all been hell because I've created hell. The minute you told me you cared about me or loved me, you got to go. And I did everything in my power to get you to say, I love you and care about you. The book talks about, on one hand, I can be kind, considerate, generous, modest, even self-sacrificing. I know how to open the door. I know how to take you out and woo you. I know how to be a nice guy. But if I don't get what I want, I become mean, egotistical, and many other defects of character. I touch one, I touch all. And I didn't know these things until I came in here. And as a result of knowing my behaviors and my characteristics when I came in here, finding out these things about myself, I was able to develop something different. I was able to see the truth about why my life looked so bad, why every relationship that I was in was torn apart. And I constantly blame. My life would look a lot better if you would just do this for me, if you would just take care of me, if you would have just bought me the car, if you would have just acknowledged me better, if mom and dad, you would have just helped me out when I needed the help. But I'm not willing to do any work to be anywhere in my life. I ain't about shit. I ain't shit. I ain't about shit. And I ain't doing shit. So I'm just shit. The one thing I did successfully around here was I became a professional skier. Not around here, but prior to getting here. And like the book talks about, Bill's story, he says, I went to the golf course to carry him around, right? Well, I became a professional skier, and I was to take over the ski industry. But alcoholism caught up with me a lot faster than I caught up with those guys. Yes, I did some films. Yes, I did some magazines and some brochures and Chronicle Couloir in Europe and test-piloted skis, and I had my profession. But I'm a has-been. And when I got sober, I tried to hold up some of these successes that I had. And I'm 36 years old, and I'm sitting in a sober living with a bunch of 18, 19, 20-year-old kids saying, you ain't shit. You're a loser. You're a failure. And shit can your jailhouse thug punk gangster mentality. I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm a solo artist, James Dean, right? But I had been to jail so many times from 2001 to 2005, 2006, that my reputation in that community was, I came out of jail. And so they had a little leg on me. First of all these young guys had time, and I didn't. And what had happened was, I'll tell you what happened. I won a beach volleyball tournament. Because when I left the ski industry, I came down, I went to Playa del Rey, and I met these cats, Chris Hanneman, Robert Chavez. These guys are professional volleyball players. And I had tree trunk legs and a 37-inch vertical. And they saw me jumping on the beach, so they trained me. And I started playing in qualifiers and in AAA volleyball. And I win this volleyball tournament. Meanwhile, for that 2-3 years of training, I'm doing cocaine and drinking a lot. And I win this volleyball tournament, and that night I hit the pipe. I don't know if any there's any crackheads in the room. But I go from being 168, 170 pounds to a gullum. Anybody know who gullum is? Anybody know who gullum is? Gollum is the one who seeks the ring in the Lord of the Rings, okay? And crack cocaine became my precious. So from 1998 until 2006, my primary purpose in life was to hit the pipe. I went from making $180,000 a year to making nothing. I went from the beach house, the rotating door, and a bunch of cars in the driveway to homeless. I went from a giver to a taker, a protector to a stalker. And I aimlessly wandered this earth with one purpose in mind, and that was to feed the allergy. To scratch the itch. You know when you're hungry, your stomach's gurgling? Rawr, 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 rawr. My fuck, I want an In-N-Out burger. I go get an In-N-Out burger, right? Craving for something, right? So when I put one in me, it sets off this allergy, and that allergy talks to my brain, and it talks to my brain in a way that it won't allow any other thought to come in. And all that is signaling me is more, 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 more. I need another, I need another. And even when I don't want to do it anyways. And I convince myself at 5 a.m. in the morning when I run out of dope and I've pushed the pipe and I've drank all the alcohol, tomorrow morning I'm going to do one. And I used to be a criminal. I've been arrested for commercial burglaries, residential burglaries, strong-arming, racketeering, drug possessions, guns, all kinds of stuff. And I did all those activities to support a habit. And every morning at 5 o'clock when I'd start to nod off and that sun would hit the windshield and I would tweak awake and I'd get that 45 minutes. But at 5 o'clock in the morning I'd be telling myself, this is it, I'm done. And I did this for years. And every morning I'd get up from that sun hitting my face, I'd go do another heist and go meet my dealer. And I did this for years. I was in a vicious cycle. I was in a vicious cycle, and I was absolutely powerless over drugs and alcohol. And I take a look at this powerlessness, a devastating weakness that no human power can relieve me of, not even myself. No matter how many times I promise myself, I don't want to do this, I can't do this, I'm going to stop on my own, I don't need AA. I drive by AA and be like, those losers. They don't know what they're doing. They don't know how to live life. They're driving nice cars, going home to a wife and a kid, got a bank account, no criminal records, some of them, right? Yes, a majority of us. There's the just drinkers, and then there's the, as matters get worse, drug addict alcoholics. The As Matters Get Worse, page 22 in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you read it, you'll see what I'm talking about. I hide shit in places so that no one can get it away from me, like alcohol and or drugs. I go to the doctors or curbside slingers to get what I need to taper off or to get that sense of ease and comfort that you talked about. I love the effect produced by drugs and alcohol, and I seek it to the end till the wheels fall off, till there's sparks flying, till the front end of the car is busted up and gone, and I'm out of gas. I'm behind the car trying to push it down the road thinking that I'm going to get somewhere. So I get here, and I get here the first time after being on house arrest. It's so funny. I have loving, enabling parents, right? Very healthy, wealthy people. And they continuously bail me out. And at one point in time, the judge is like, you know what? Jail or house arrest instead of just like OR, probation, fine. And so I end up doing this house arrest thing, and I'm just the whole 118 days that I'm on house arrest, I am just stealing and piling, stackpiling, so that when the time comes and I get off this house arrest, I can go do what I need to do. And my parents find out about it. The detectives come. She's like, yo, go to treatment or go to jail. I'm like, damn, it's jail or house arrest. Now it's jail or treatment. Like, so I grab a toothbrush, pair of board shorts. By the way, I don't wear pants or shoes. I'm like flip-flops and board shorts. And it's, I don't remember what time of year it was, but it was around 2003. And I go to treatment. And after 30 days of hearing H&I panels, going to 60 meetings in 30 days, and hearing the H&Is come, and hearing speakers talk about just get a sponsor, do the steps, blah, 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 blah. You know, you don't need sober living, this, that, and the other. And I bought into the idea that I didn't need further character development, that I could do this on my own. And I white-knuckled it after that 30-day program for a year, 3 months, and 5 days. And what ended up happening was in that year, 3 months and 5 days, I started dating the heir to Toyota, some beautiful girl. I was managing a restaurant. I'd bought a boat, and I was doing well. So I thought material-wise, life picked up for me. And the guy who I was buying the boat from sold it under me, called the sheriff. Sheriffs came down, were like, guns drawn. I'm like, yo, I got receipts. And then he's on the phone, speakerphone, threatening to kill me. And then my girlfriend says, I need you to pick me up at the airport, and I'm late. And she's like, you're unaccountable. I can't be with someone who's not accountable. I live a hectic life. You need to know that. My boss calls me into the office and says, hey, there's been a dispute over the tips and blah, 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 and we're not going to be able to give you this much, whatever, this week, but next week. And I'm like, I need that money, fuck you. And he's like, well, you're fired, fine. So I lose my job, I lose my girlfriend, I lose my place of living, and it's pouring down rain, and all I have is a 67 classic Volkswagen Bug with like four pair of skis in it and everything I own, and a dog. And my friend Yoji tells me, come stay with me, but Wednesday nights, this was a Wednesday night, he's like, I have acting class till 10 o'clock at night, you'll have to wait till I get home. And I'm sitting out in front of his house, and his neighbor comes running downstairs, and he's like, hey, my mom feels bad, you can come up and stay upstairs. And that night, they were smoking weed and drinking alcohol, and I took a hit of weed. The first drug I ever took was weed. The second drug I ever took was alcohol, beer. And thus started my journey. I had a year, 3 months, 5 days sober. That night, I took a hit of weed. I drank a beer. And for the next 2 years, I smoked crack criminally. Strong-arming, racketeering, commercial burglaries. Extremely violent. And I had gotten busted for a petty theft. And somehow paperwork didn't come all together on the judge's desk, and he was like, OR, see you in 6 months. And for the next 6 months, I'm crying, hitting the pipe, $300-$400 a day. I could not put it down, and my life looked like a tragedy, train wreck. And so when I saw the judge that time, I admitted for the first time in front of anybody, even to myself, I said, Your Honor, I do all this stuff to support a drug and alcohol problem. I think I got a real problem with drugs and alcohol. The jail is not helping me. I need help. So I went back to the same treatment facility where these 16 and 17-year-old kids were telling me, you ain't shit, motherfucker, sit the fuck down. And that was on a, I did 45 days in jail until I got minute ordered out, and then I landed in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous, and I met my sponsor the very first meeting I went to. And I didn't walk up and ask him if he would sponsor me. A friend of mine introduced me to him, a cat that I used to party with. And that guy is like, sure, dude, I'll sponsor you. And from the gate, from the moment I met that guy, I knew something was going to change within me. From the moment I had admitted that I was a drug, that I was a drug addict and alcoholic, I knew something was going to change within me because I had been in so much denial for years and years and years and years. I'm like, yeah, I smoke a little too much weed and drink a little too much, but I could not admit to my innermost self this until I admitted it in front of the judge. What had happened was drugs and alcohol had humbled me into a terrific beating where I came from a good life, mansion-style living as a kid, beach house, successful career, professional athlete, to destruction. How it happened so fast, look at your own experience. Then I look at this unmanageable life. First of all, we know that little good comes to any alcoholic who joins AA unless he can first accept this devastating weakness and all of its consequences. And until he humbles himself, you'll find no happiness at all. And I had been humbled by alcohol. I had been humbled by drugs. And the first thing my sponsor asked me, he said, what do you want from Alcoholics Anonymous? And I rattled off these four things as fast as I could. I said, I don't want to think the way I think. I don't want to feel the way I feel. I don't want to do the things that I've been doing. And I sure as hell don't ever want to touch drugs and alcohol, especially crack cocaine, ever again. He said, you're in the right place. And my journey started. And he told me that night, write down the names of every single person you know. I'll meet you tomorrow. I'll pick you up tomorrow night from your rehab, and we'll start on step one. So, all right, so we line by line, page by page, paragraph by paragraph, and each line turned into a question, so on and so forth. And I went through this process. And he had taught me some things about why am I asking me some things about why are you turning your will and life over to this newfound providence, this God or this creative intelligence? Why are you? Well, the answers are given to me in the book, but the reality behind it was, this is the question I needed to ask myself. What did your will do to you? Not what it did for you, but what did it do to you? And what my will did to me was it destroyed me. It destroyed me and everything that I touched. Domino effect. I can't think about how many people I owe an amends to still because of the impact I might have just had on one person out there and how they took how they were impacted by what I did and spewed it out in many directions. So I dove into this process. I wasn't about the clicky, hanging out with cliques, standing around talking about the same bullshit over and over and over and over and over. And do you know what so-and-so did? Do you know what so-and-so did? Oh my God, did you? That's a bunch of fucking shit talking. Bunch of self-righteous, perverse satisfaction, claiming my righteousness, shit-talking. My sponsor said, do not hang out in those cliques. You will get sicker and sicker and sicker. You are to do work. You are to pray. You are to sit in the front row. You are to shut the fuck up and listen. You are to open your eyes. You are not to sit on your phone during meetings. I didn't have a cell phone at the time. I did, but it was locked away. I wasn't allowed to talk to women. I wasn't allowed to drive my car. I wasn't allowed to have a job. I wasn't allowed to have a cell phone. My sponsor told me that's a good thing because sobriety is about learning how to live without everything except for two things, principles and God. So my journey started with prayer, and every single morning I'd wake up and get on my knees and pray, and I'd make my bed, and I had to make my bed, and I had to line my shoes up, and my clothes had to be nice and clean, and all. It's that. You, the crazy thing is that's what it looks like in my house today. There's no dishes. The trash is not overflowing. There's no ants in my house. The windows are clean. The mirrors are clean. The toilets are clean. The floors are clean. There's no junk. Although I have a 6-year-old daughter. I'm like picking up after her constantly. So the question I had to ask myself is, what did my will do for me? And the answers were right there. It had ultimately destroyed myself. And I had to look at these seven requirements in the third step, the first one being, am I convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success? And on that basis, I am not almost, not sometimes, not perhaps. I am always in collision with everything that gets in front of me. The problem is I'm in collision with self. And when I'm in collision with self, I'm in collision with everything. I'm indecisive, inconsiderate, I'm discontented, which means I'm never satisfied, even when things are perfect, I'll find flaw. What am I asking God to help me build? A relationship with Him, a new relationship with myself, building a new character, developing and rebuilding those old relationships and repeating this over and over again. Why am I asking God to relieve me of the bondage of self? Because I live in the protestations of self. All I give a shit about is me. I'm a taker. I'm not thinking about your well-being or your well-being or what I could do for you. Because I don't care about you. The craziest thing is I didn't give a shit about myself either. I could tell you I love my family, but my actions didn't show it. I love them down in here, but the things that came out of my mouth and the broken glass and the destruction and all the cars I totaled and the indignant fuck yous and you owe me's, the entitlement. They, at 17 and 18 years old, left the house, went to college, full-time job, and developed a big life. And I'm back at home at 32 years old. I left at 14. You know, I got a job and I was out. But to have to go back home because of drugs and alcohol and then have some entitlement, like you owe me. I'm the baby of the family. They still take care of my oldest brother. It's a sad thing because he refuses to see this way of living. The second requirement was that I make a decision to turn my will and life over to this, that I take this position as the agent. The third requirement is I wholeheartedly do it. I take this position as the agent. Fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh requirement is I voice it without reservation. God, you can have my will. I don't want it. I now clearly see what my will does to me and to other people. I don't want my will anymore. It's of no value to me. And the eighth requirement, set six and seven, is I honestly and humbly made that third step prayer. I didn't just recite that prayer like a rap song. The eighth requirement says, next we launch on a vigorous course of action, which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us have never attempted. As far as I ever got was, it's your fault. As far as I ever got is, my life's the way it is because y'all motherfuckers didn't act right. I lived continuously on page 60 and 61. I forced people to do what I wanted so that I would be okay. I put expectations on others to meet, to satisfy my desires in life. And after I did my four step, nasty. It's like it took me 2 weeks to write 480 resentments and a bunch of fears and a ridiculous inventory on harm's conduct, that less people had hurt me in minor, little, tedious, petty shit. But the kind of destruction I did to other people was just ridiculous. And at the end of that inventory, the only person that I hated was some dumb white bald dude. And so I was able to read this inventory to my sponsor. I was able to get rigorously honest, every twist of character, every dark corner of the past, everything that had happened to me, that I had done to others. And not to tell you that the four step was like this white light experience, and I was like, oh, I floated above. I cried. I laughed. I'm like, I can't believe I've been holding on to some of this shit for 40 years, 30, 35 years. Yes, I had been doing some things to be in the solution and start to solve some problems, but from one through five, I am just looking at the problem. The real development of character begins in step six. And I had a laundry list of defects of character. I usually bring a sheet and read it off. It's alphabetical. There's 130 of them. It's crazy. And I don't know anything about integrity. I don't know anything about humility, right? I think humility is like, you humiliated me. My God. But humility, it says, it's a priceless gift. That it's the avenue to freedom of the spirit. It's a healer of my pain. Because it's very humbling for anyone to stand here and go, my name's Johnny, I'm an alcoholic. And my life has become unmanageable because I'm trying to manage it. So when I do this second step, my name is Johnny, I'm an alcoholic, my life is unmanageable because I'm trying to manage it, and I'm insane. I don't think straight. It's broken down. It's awful to admit that I have warped my mind into such an obsession for destructive thinking that only an act of providence can remove it from me. There's a solution there, by the way. It can be removed. Sanity can be restored. I can't fix this with the thing that broke it. And it's humbling to write the four step. It's humbling to follow direction. It's humbling to greet people at the door because your sponsor told you to get a commitment. It's humbling. These things are all about humility. It's a foundating principle of all of this. To pray and meditate. To go help others. I think I wanted to drive 4 hours down here today. I didn't, right? I'm like, Thursday, catch the flu. I'm like, oh, better be a 24-hour. Got up this morning and just beasted. Went to work. Got in the car at 2 o'clock. Didn't get down here until 5:40 from L.A. Should have taken me an hour and 30 minutes. I drive 100 miles an hour. Yeah. But I was willing to go to any lengths to smoke crack, to drink alcohol. I was willing to go to any lengths to hurt people. I used to have road rage. Last time I pulled someone over, got next to him in the car, and I'm like, blah, 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 motherfucker, and he pulled a gun on me. I was like, I'm done with road rage. I made a left so fast. I didn't care if there was oncoming traffic. I will never say another word to another person driving in. That was like another moment of being humbled. Because they would just deport this guy, right? Some Russian cab driver, like, blah, blah, blah. You get the I'm a dad. I need to learn the restraint of tongue. I'm going to say this real quick. Ladies, thank you. I was on non-com with women for the first 9 months of my sobriety. I went through a super gnarly structured sober living. No ladies. Bad news for you, guy. You are a perverted stalker. Leave the ladies alone. But what happened was I actually met some women around here, some ladies, girls. I got problems with you. I'm a problem. Okay? Ladies, women, thank you. Because when I did get finally able to start talking to women, they embraced me. And they smacked my hand when I was being a bad boy. And when I was looking in wrong directions, they would aim me back in the right direction. They kept me here. I have to look here and not down because I have this toe thing, you know. And so, Lori Rossi likes to wear open-toed shoes, but not tonight. But Lori was one of the women who actually, and a handful of others who actually really taught me how to be a gentleman, how to respect women, how to be a son to my mom, how to be a husband to my wife, how to be a dad to my daughter. The women of the rooms have really made a major impact on who I am today. I don't go down that route anymore. I was a sick fuck. And I'm grateful for the tolerance and compassion and understanding, because I'll say I'm a sick fuck. You can call yourself whatever you want. And Tanya Ford called me Filthy Boy, and like I have nicknames around the rooms from women with 20 plus years of sobriety that watched me grow up as a child around here, as a grown man who acted like a child. And I'm back involved with the ski industry, and I own my own business now, and I have a wonderful wife, and like I can't tell you how many material things I have. I'm like, I need to gut it. Like, I want to throw half of it away, right? I got too much. I like the simple life. Less is more. I just wish I could go back to, like, sitting in sober living and just, like, making my bed and going to a meeting and then sitting in a group and, hi, I'm Johnny, I'm an alcoholic, and what's going on today? Oh, I'm fine. Like, I wish I could just go do that again for, like, a month. Take a fucking vacation. But I went to any lengths to get loaded. And I'm willing to go to any lengths for my recovery. And I've been there and back. I spoke in Canada. I spoke in Barstow. I spoke on a boat in the Mediterranean. I just got back from a heli ski trip. Life's good. I've learned how to manage my money. I've learned how to allow God and others to manage my thinking and my actions. And I've learned how to be emotionally balanced around here. The ultimate goal around here is independence and emotional balance. And if I'm emotionally balanced, life looks good. I get loaded because I'm emotionally imbalanced and my instincts run riot. And that's the perverse soul sickness that I lived in prior to getting here. Lord, I love you. Forever grateful. If it was anyone else, I'd have told them to fuck off. Because I got a backbone today, man. I tell you. I went from people-pleasing to having a backbone. But for Lori Rossi, I would do anything. I'd cross the country for her if she needed my help. And that's what kind of friends I have in my sobriety and in my life today, is that I have people that will do anything for me, and I would do anything for them. And it's not owed. We don't owe each other nothing. We just do it because that's what that's what Alcoholics Anonymous had taught me to do, is to suit up, show up no matter what, and help one another out. My life as an ex-problem drinker constantly depends upon the positive thoughts of others and how I can help meet their needs. My name is Johnny. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you.